around the world, and that we are this military outpost and continue to be used that way by the U.S. military.
Dr. Beamer, even just outside your house, you say you sometimes can feel the live fire testing. You're calling for an end to that. And do you see this movement going in the same direction as the one in Puerto Rico?
Yes, it's truthful. Anyone that lives here on Hawaii Island, especially in Waimea, in my hometown, feels their home shake when they bomb Pohakuloa. It's egregious. It hurts you deep in your soul. You know, as a Kanaka, as an indigenous person to these islands, to feel our aina tremble and shake because of bombing and weapons of war and destruction. This issue here in Red Hill is a serious threat to the future lives and any economy on Oahu and for all of Hawaii. This is the most critical threat that we've ever had to our groundwater resources. And in fact, this is the kind of terrorist act and threat the military is supposed to protect Hawaii from. And yet they're the cause of it here in our islands. It's terrible, it's egregious, and it must stop. We must shut down the tanks immediately.
And I wanted to ask also, Camilla, you were part of the protests against the 30-meter telescope on the summit of Mauna Kea. Could you talk about that as well?
Yes. So, and many of our people were, Kamana was there as well. It was, I would say, the largest uprising of our people for, in my generation at least. I don't know how much longer. But our people are educated. Our people are knowledgeable about what's going on in our lands. And our commitment is really to the protection of this place, to our aina, to our land, and to our wai, to our water. And so that was a struggle against the state of Hawaii, as well as a multi-billion dollar corporation and that is backed by many countries. And we understand as a people that we don't have military might, we don't have, firepower, but we do have a strength in that our people can come together in peace and nonviolence, and we will stand up and we will stand for the protection of these places and of our resources.
Camille, we have to leave it there. I thank you so much, Camille Kalama, as well as Professor Kamana Beamer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
And you can stay safe by getting vaccinated. If you've been vaccinated, please get the booster. And if you've done all of that, please tell others. You're listening to 90.1 FM and 107.3 FM in Stony Brook. This is WUSB Stony Brook. It's Tuesday evening. It's 6 p.m. That means it's time for another edition of Off the Wall. A very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Yo, hey, I'm over here. Can you bring me up? I'd like to join the broadcast.
I'm bringing you up. Your microphone's very far
in. I feel like I'm lower than you. I feel like you're looking down on me for some reason.
I'm wondering why you're so low to the ground.
I'll tell you why.
You have to lean into the microphone.
I haven't invested in a fancy apparatus, shall I say, to hold my microphone. It's still one of these little kind of portable deals, so it's not that great. But
right,
you know what
right.
is fantastic?
But could you
fantastic?
Invest in it? Can you invest in a chair, maybe? So
being...
You know, that, you deserve
to
be...
I'm sitting. I'm seated.
I can barely tell. Looks like you're... Okay, whatever.
It does look like I'm crouching.
I just don't want it to be uncomfortable for you or the listeners.
No, I'm just trying not to spill my drink.
Yeah. A great coffee today, by the way. Great coffee.
It's Christmas coffee.
It is. Everything is Christmassy, except for the weather. Where is the snow? Where is the snow? Well, pandemonium everywhere, of course, as the Omicron variant makes its way through our lives.
Boy, the Omicronom?
Yeah, it's. I'm sure there's all kinds of good songs about it. I'm sure there are.
Plenty.
How do you think it feels, though, to hear your alphabet used this way? You know, imagine if everybody in the world was talking about W. Well, wait, they already did that with Bush, didn't they? Or K, you know, just an innocent letter. Well, actually, K is not that innocent. How about E? E is a good letter. If people were calling it the E variant, you know, I take personal offense at that. But to have, you know, a letter from the Greek alphabet, Omicron, just being used in this way. When you say Omicron, you don't think, oh, that's how you spell this particular word in Greek. No, it's kind of sad, I think.
Isn't it?
Yeah. You hear Biden's talk today, this afternoon?
He spoke, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He's giving out 500 million home tests.
I'm a little confused about that.
You know, I understood when Jen Psaki was asked last week, why don't we just give one to everybody, the absurdity of sending it to everybody for a one-time test. And everyone's making fun of her for saying that. It is absurd to send everybody a test, even people who haven't asked for one, and then assume that's going to solve anything because, you know, you could catch it a week later easily. So what you need is access to tests, and I think that is what they're trying to do right now, right? I mean, people can't get tests. It's very hard. go to CVS's website, CVS.com. Look for the COVID home test there, and you'll see it's in stock in many stores. But I guarantee you, not one of those stores has it. Their website just, it's full of lies. It really is. And that's a quote from a CVS employee, because they're getting calls all the time. Do you have the home testing kit? No, we don't. Why do you think we do? Because your damn website says you do.
It's down to, like, you can kind of get an idea of their delivery cycle. That's basically as much information as they know is, oh yeah, well, we'll get it when we get it, and no doubt when it arrives, because they've told so many people when they get these kits, they fly off the shelves because everybody knows, and they show up and buy everything.
I was able to get one by ordering online and having it delivered in a plain envelope, and that worked last week. That does not work anymore. So, yeah, you have to move fast. You have to be a little bit lucky. But this is going to change like everything else has changed. With 500 million of them being made available, I think everybody will have access probably in a couple of weeks. For now, though, just stay safe. It's easy to stay safe. We know how to do this. We've been at it for almost 2 years now. Wear a damn mask. You know, I got to speak out about this, Kyle, because it really annoys me.
Go ahead.
We were in a local establishment a couple of days ago. And we saw this this ambulance, EMT vehicle, parked directly in front of the door, you know, just blocking the door. And not only was it parked illegally directly in front of the door, the two people inside were just there to get food. You know, I can overlook that. Fine. You're just being dumbasses. But they were the only two people in the entire establishment not wearing masks. Now, I'm not talking about people who are dining at tables, and I'll get to that in a second, but people standing around the cashier themselves, the people in the kitchen, all looking a little bit nervous. Like, do we say something about this? These two guys just chatting openly. You're EMTs, for God's sake. You should know better. You are exposed to so much in the course of any day. And to walk around in public without a mask inside an enclosed area? I mean, what kind of message does that send, first of all, to everybody else? I don't know what kind of, you know, political things are going on here. But from a health perspective, that is just dumb. And seriously.
And these are the people that want all the, like, consideration and to be lauded for their heroism. And mm-hmm. When there's a levy or some kind of bill or proposition to fund the rebuilding a fire station or wherever, you know, they're always there with their hand out and wanting their
as they should be
badges polished.
No,
or whatever.
I mean, seriously, I'm having a hard time calling these particular people heroes. But generally, that's what they are. They show up. They bring people back to life. They save lives. They do all kinds of things like that. So why do you think so low of your own life that you would risk something like that and also risk the people around you that you're supposedly there to help? So Terryville Fire Department, yeah, I'm calling you out by name. I'm not going to call the people out by name. I don't want them to get in trouble. But maybe you could send a message to your staff. Do better on that front. And I'm sure you do great things on other fronts, and kudos for that. But seriously, EMTs, you know, back when this started, they were the people we looked to for guidance. And now, anti-maskers, anti-vaccine people, you know, do you not see the numbers around us? Do you not know that 800,000 of our fellow citizens have died from this disease? And while some of them may have been old, some of them may have been sick, doesn't mean that that's an excuse. Doesn't mean they wouldn't still be alive today. And that's only some of them. Many of them were also very healthy people. Many of them were young people. And we're looking at a future where now we've got this variant that is spreading like gangbusters. Fortunately, is that it's not as serious for those people who get it. At least those people who are vaccinated who get it. And there's no guarantee for the people who aren't vaccinated. Now, imagine if that were not the case, how screwed we would be. Imagine if this was something that was spreading much, much faster than Delta, and it was much deadlier than Delta, and it was immune to the vaccine. All of that is possible. All of that is possible. And the reason these variants come about is because the virus is still out there. And the reason the virus is still out there is because we haven't gotten vaccines to all parts of the world, and because there are so many dumbasses around us now who, for some reason or another, have decided not to get the vaccine and are spreading the disease around, hurting those people around them, hurting themselves. You know, even
I'm so upset at deniers, and like that alone is so I cannot just it'll be a lifelong exercise in restraint and patience.
Yeah, no, it will be. But did you hear this? Even Trump got his booster. And he told there's a MAGA crowd. Why are there MAGA crowds?
He's trying to be out there in the speaking realms. Yeah.
Okay, fine. They're doing that again.
He's showing up.
They're doing that again. Great. So he told this crowd that he got the booster. And they booed him. I mean, great. You booed him. That's step one. But you're booing him for that? For the one smart thing he did? You know, and actually, this is a repeat of history, because when he said that he got the vaccine a year or so ago, the crowd booed him too. I don't get the agenda here. You know, okay, fine. You don't like Anthony Fauci. You're entitled to not like him. Sure, you're not entitled to threaten his life like a Fox News host did. But whatever, you can like or not like whoever you want. But listen to somebody else then. Listen to another scientist. Listen to another doctor. Listen to somebody else. You know, a doctor in the field. You know, not a doctor of the fine arts or whatever. I don't know why I'm picking on them. But not somebody who does not know about viruses and just has their own theories about it without actually backing it up with provable science. You know, there aren't millions of these people out there all part of a conspiracy. I don't even know what the conspiracy is exactly. How is getting a jab in the arm part of a conspiracy? Are we going to become zombies? Or I don't know. I'm never interested enough to really pursue it because it just breaks down so quickly.
Well, I just wonder, like, you know, if you applied it to any other scenario where this thing just magically appeared and humans were responding to it and reaching consensus about it and mm-hmm. said, let's use this as a strategy against this foreign thing from nature, essentially. It could be from outer space. You know, take all the politics and the labels off of it. And let's just say, as a human enterprise, we've sorted out that the best strategy is this particular treatment. We've you know, been through years of that now.
Mm-hmm.
Would you not want to accept that consensus versus taking your, like, rolling the dice, as is being said a lot, or just taking your chances?
For no good reason. For no good reason other than to be contrarian. And I get being contrarian. I get taking the devil's advocate view. That's fine.
Being skeptical.
That's healthy. Yeah, being skeptical, asking questions. But at some point, you have to accept the facts. You know, you have to look around. And, you know, we do it all the time. We have ideas, opinions, and many times we're wrong. Not on this. Not on this, because it is just so universally accepted. It's like, you know, arguing about gravity or about the Earth being flat. And yeah, there are people who might do that, but come on already. It's time for the rest of the human race to move on.
It's a sea of confirmation bias that is untenable for real thinking, intelligent participants in civil society. But I think a lot of other people are, as you said, just completely shut down to anything but what they want to hear that basically confirms something that isn't true factually, mm-hmm. has been found to be, in fact, a real problem in telling people in honesty and in getting the right information to people so they can make an informed decision with themselves. And it's just, I feel so many ways. We're going to end up going nonstop about this.
I know.
You got to hold me back.
I feel like we're saying the same thing week after week. But the reason we keep saying the same thing week after week is because things aren't changing. Well, actually, I'm wrong on that. Things are changing. The positivity rate now in Suffolk County, you know, it was 3% only a couple of months ago. It's now 14%. What that number means, that's the percentage of positive cases for the tests that are taken. I don't imagine home tests are included on that, because how would they know? These are tests where you actually go somewhere and get tested. If 3% of the people are testing positive, that's not good, but it's better than where we are right now. 14%, that number has been skyrocketing. So that gives you a sense as to how quickly this is spiraling out of control. And while we may say now it's not as serious as the other variants, again, that could change at any time. And those of you who are not vaccinated, it doesn't matter. You can get extremely sick even with the Omicron variant. So you have to take this seriously.
And thinking a couple steps further than that, that permissive behavior creates the circumstances for future mutations, and this ultimately continuing even longer,
yeah.
Which has been the whole point of trying to get transmissibility and infectiousness and just prevalence overall down as much as possible.
It's never changed. It's funny because I don't know who the guy is on Fox News who threatened Fauci. It's funny how on CNN, if an anchor helps their brother with their defense and violates journalistic norms by doing that, immediately kicked off the air, and rightfully so. But somebody on Fox threatens the life of Fauci, claiming it's a joke. But if you listen to the quote, my God, what kind of a joke is that? And how many people are going to take it seriously? They're still there. They're still there. My damn phone keeps going. I'll explain that later. I have a lot of things to explain later. So basically, you have this person on Fox News who is blaming Fauci, saying that you invested in the Chinese lab that allegedly was responsible for the virus. So it's all your fault, or you're part of it, or something like that. You have these people saying things like that. Okay. And then, you know, they're saying this virus is bad. you know, and we want to blame China for it. We want to say it came from Wuhan, whatever. You get to do that, but you also say it's a serious virus. People are dying. Will you encourage people to take the vaccine? No. How do you have it both ways? How do you say this is a deadly virus that Fauci is somehow responsible for, but yet you won't say people should take the vaccine? Makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, it's a total paradox or a contradictory thing to try to juggle. And there's so many people appealing to people around them and just saying this kind of stuff that they've basically turned it into a sort of talking point or but testing it on their friends and trying to get support for ideas that are just loony. And in doing so, putting themselves and people around them at great, huge risk and not, again, not believing or listening or thinking that their arguments are flawed in any way until it's too late. And that's the worst. That is the worst part. And there's very little information and you know, people basically meet really bitter ends with this. There was a representative or a senator in Washington.
That's right, a state senator in your state.
Yeah. Turns out was lost. People didn't know where he was. He was in El Salvador.
He went to El Salvador, got COVID, and was he vaccinated or not? I know he spoke out against vaccine mandates, which to me is the same thing as speaking out against the vaccine, because what you're doing is saying it's okay if you don't get the vaccine. It's your decision. You know, it's something that that you have every right to decide on.
Yeah, and was known for a lot of other pretty horrid policies in his tenure there. So I'm sure he'll want to be remembered for all of those as well. But the idiocy of resisting and fighting and denying, and then meeting this end, disappearing, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. disappearing, being lost. It's astounding. And there's less representation in Washington as a result, to say the least. It's so crazy to even think about that. But I'm thinking of many other examples, and it's so unfair to, you know, be sad and upset and feel for them and their loss, but at the same time realize how much was brought about and was a part of this and was their own doing and this reticence and refusal.
Lee Zeldin, I'm sorry, I don't mean to curse on the air, but Lee Zeldin is a curse. That's our elected representative here on Long Island. Lee Zeldin has stood in the way of vaccine mandates, has opposed wearing masks, basically has been a proponent of the virus from the beginning. And God knows how many people have died as a result of that.
Did you say opponent?
No, did I say no? Proponent.
Yeah, proponent. Yeah,
did I say opponent? I'm not. You know, I don't know what I'm saying, half the time. But this time, I do know what I'm saying.
Opposed to people that are against it. Yes.
Yeah.
In practice.
Will you let me say what I'm trying to say? So basically, he has stood in the way of. For instance, our governor Hochul has issued a mandate of various sorts for restaurants and stores and things like that. And they're basically coming into existence around the area because this is a crisis. And Lee Zeldin is standing up saying, no, don't do that. You can't do that. Let people do whatever they want. You know, as if the last 2 years haven't happened. That is our representative. That is what he is saying. Do you think Lee Zeldin has gotten vaccinated? Of course he's gotten vaccinated. Of course he's taking care of himself. When you talk about, you know, friends telling other friends irresponsible things and basically just spouting a whole lot of nonsense and these friends paying with their lives, that is what is happening on a governmental scale. That is what is happening for the people that we trust, that we put in power. They are basically betraying that trust, telling us to go play in traffic, telling us to basically do dangerous things, throwing our lives away. And they lose nothing. They lose nothing as a result of that. And no matter what, and it's time that we stop trying to win these people over, because no matter what happens, they will always find a way to say, well, this proves that I was right. You know, it's like arguing with a libertarian. I'm sorry, I don't mean to pick on libertarians, but my God, they're such a pain in the ass to argue with because they never stop.
Onerous.
I don't think I've ever gotten a libertarian to say, you know what, you're right. Doesn't work that way. They just will find some other thing, and if they can find some other thing, they'll lead you down a path of nonsense. I'm going to get letters. I know I'm going to get letters, but it's just frustrating, you know? At least with Republicans, I can just say, you know what? It's not even worth talking to you sometimes. But libertarian, you know, and people in the Libertarian Party are always saying, you know, you're a libertarian. You say a lot of things that are what libertarians stand for. No, yeah. I am not. I am not one of you. I am not one of you. I will never be one of you. Stop saying I'm one of you. If I agree on one thing, it doesn't mean I agree on anything else. And if you want to work together for that one thing, fine. I'll work with anybody to get something done, but I'm not one of you. Anyway, so we have problems on all levels, nationally, locally, interpersonal relationships, that kind of thing. And we need to do better. Now, when I was talking, I'd mention this later on. People in restaurants. There's been a lot made of this. How come you have to wear a mask when you walk into a restaurant, but it's okay to sit down and have food and not have the mask on? Well, clearly, you can't eat food with a mask on. There's that. But secondly, yeah, it sounds silly. It does sound silly. I you know, and even if it is silly, if that makes people feel better, why not just do it? You know, I see people walking down the street with masks on. I know outdoors doesn't make much of a difference. I still feel better seeing them do that because I know they're making an effort and they care. All right. But in this particular case, inside restaurants, it does make a bit of sense because when you first walk into a place, you're seeing all kinds of people at the register, at the door. It's not really a controlled exchange of droplets. Whereas if you're sitting at a table with the person you walked in with, the only time that you're exposed to other people's droplets is when the waitress or waiter leans in and says, is everything okay? And you say, well, it was up until now when you infected us with whatever you have. But no, you didn't infect us because you're wearing a mask. You see how it works? So I would avoid restaurants myself because I want to be extra careful. But get takeaway, you can definitely do that. But if you're in a restaurant, that is the safest way to do it. And mocking it and causing a hard time for the people who work there, what do you gain? What are you gaining? Even if it's wrong, what hill are you dying on? What battle are you fighting exactly? You know, there are so many more important things that we're ignoring. And this is not something that's worth getting log jammed over. And that's what's been happening.
Often people are walking out of a restaurant when you're walking in, too.
That's true. You bump into them.
Like, you have to be right next to them. There's a doorway, you know, you hold the door.
Uh-huh.
And you say,
don't even do that on the radio. You make people wince when you do that.
Yeah. And you say, have a good day.
Do you think we could convince people you can catch COVID over the radio?
Yeah, it's radio wave born.
If we could infiltrate some of these groups, and listeners, here's an exercise for you. If you infiltrate, pretty much anything goes now. Any theory that you have, as long as they don't think that you're working for somebody else, they'll consider it. They'll consider it. So you can come up with mind control plots that are being hatched in back rooms or I don't know. The imagination is the limit. I've seen some pretty crazy things being said at these rallies, on these websites, even in our mail that gets sent to us, sometimes even over our airwaves. Yeah, it's true. It's everywhere. You have to fight it on every level.
Well, let's stick to... Stick to the stuff that's important, and that's talking about local events, things that are happening on campus, at Stony Brook, and in the wider world.
Stony Brook is great. We've been doing it right from the start, I think. Built a new hospital that fortunately we didn't need, but we might still in the future.
I was going to say, you know, it's worth someone taking a little field trip, see if that is changing. I know the testing sites were taken away. Maybe some of that will come back. Things are going to be dynamic like that. That was my thought last year when the vaccines are becoming more widely available. It's like, okay, so what are we doing to prepare for when it's not a respiratory illness, it's some other illness? You know, how are we ready? I really hope that someone is thinking about that other than me.
But also people coming onto campus and being on campus. People wear masks inside buildings. You cannot come onto campus. This includes the radio station. You cannot go to the radio station if you have not been tested or if you have not been vaccinated, period. And that is smart. That is not being followed in other places. It should be. If it were, we'd be in much better shape. We would not be looking at a 14% positivity rating today in Suffolk County. That is insane. That is bad. And that's why a lot of people are staying indoors.
Yeah, I really hope this changes. I hope everyone's out there, comes back and enjoys next year for the fight of our species. And I just hope that this doesn't cripple so many other important things. It really is hampering life.
If it does, it's our own fault.
Yeah, really. It is. Absolutely.
We know how this thing works now. We can deal with it. We just have to allocate the resources, and people have to get on board. All right. That's all I want to say on this. Something else, Governor Kathy Hochul said last Thursday that all New Yorkers should be able to vote by mail, raising the question of whether the state would join 9 others that automatically send ballots to voters. Your state, Kyle, is one of them. Your state, Washington, sends you a ballot. Even if you're here in New York, you get that ballot forwarded to you and you can vote.
Not only a ballot, it also sends you the pamphlet. So you get a statement from the candidates and a description of their positions and other information that helps prepare you where to go and read more on their site, et cetera, et cetera.
She says, I believe everyone should be able to vote by mail. That's a radical proposition to some, and to others, just makes sense. Why are there barriers to people exercising the most basic right in a democracy? It's been successful in other states. And I have to say, in your state, Kyle, Washington State, it has been very successful. Oregon is another example of it being very successful. You have a turnout rate, in Oregon, in the year 2000, when they first started this, 80% of the state's voters cast ballots in 2000. 80%. When have we ever had 80%? That is success right there. And no, it's not people's dogs voting or anything like that. It's as secure a system as we have right now.
This also, I think, allows for more complete participation because it gives you time and it allows for you to have flexibility. If you are a student or you're a working parent or you're just working and you can't make that one day, and I hear this a lot, the excuse is, the polls and voting and election day, it's a tradition, it has to be this way, it has to be that way. I don't believe in that. I don't think that that's right. I think that is a saying that it is a single moment, a crescendo of electioneering, and that voting early isn't appropriate because things change so quickly in elections. So if you vote weeks early, that's another excuse that's often trotted out in this argument. And I find it is really disingenuous because these are fake problems.
Yeah,
having a tradition is not as good as having flexibility and practicality for those people that are out there affected by the services and
it's,
the institutions.
It's about people turning out. Now, look,
but
what the Republicans are doing is trying to limit access to the polls. They're trying to make it hard. They're trying to exclude groups of people. They're trying to redraw districts and make it so that some people's votes don't count as much as others, and there is no other interpretation of that. And they oppose voting by mail. Why? Because when more people vote, they lose. That is a fact. Repeat that. Drill that into your head. When more people vote, Republicans lose. That's why they don't like cities. That's why they don't like high turnouts. When that happens, they lose. When they convince the rest of us to stay home or make it impossible for us to vote, that's when they win. And they've been doing that very well the last few years. They've been doing a great job making it hard for people to vote or redistricting things so that votes don't count.
Down to intimidation?
Absolutely.
Or
they're going to do more, much more.
we're outlawing providing water, etc. We went through this in the last cycle, and it is not going away, and in fact needs attention. It's dire.
Yeah. So you know, Lee Zeldin and other Republicans will be against this, guaranteed. I haven't seen exactly what he has said about it, but I know he is not going to be for having more people in New York being able to vote. I know that for a fact. And you have to ask why. Why wouldn't you want more people voting? People who are eligible to vote, people who are legally voting, because those are the only people who are voting. I mean, you can say that that's not true, but you got to prove it. You can't just say it. And every investigation into this has backed that up. There is no significant voter fraud. In fact, there's more voter fraud from the Republican side than from the Democratic side. That's just how it's turned out.
Yeah, all of these things. It comes up with voter ID, too. I honestly think a voter registration card is voter ID. And voter ID is a made-up term. Mm-hmm. I find it is jargon to restrict access. I think there's also discussion about using utility bills and stuff like that to verify your residence and compare that with voter registration rolls.
Yes, but what if you don't have a residence? What if
some
you're homeless?
Some people don't
have
a
homeless
house.
People,
yeah.
Homeless people still have the right to vote.
Again, it's limiting. It just the more criteria you add to this, it makes it more difficult to and narrows the mm-hmm. the elector the people who are considering the electorate and it is or the electorate themselves. They are responsible and having the widest possible source of input, you get a broader and more true sense of what's needed in that area.
And again, you know, this call for voter ID in places that don't have it, it's fixing a problem that doesn't exist.
The thing with the mail-in, it's like that paper record. There's also a unique code, so it can be checked online. There's a lot of features of it.
And your vote still stays
your
anonymous.
Your signature is verified. They keep records of everyone's signature.
But not of your vote.
No, not the actual vote. But it's been tested. It's been used in so many ways. And it's the one thing that standardized testing in school trains you for is circling bubbles on optical scan forms.
All right, moving on. Huntington has become the latest town to opt out of marijuana sales. You know, you're seeing this tidal wave of reactionary panic, and people are seeing legalization of marijuana as some kind of hell that's being unleashed when it couldn't be further from the truth. We know of what we speak. We've been to many states. We've examined what dispensaries are like, how they work. We've seen the results. We've seen the increased income. We've seen the increased jobs. We've seen the decline in drug abuse and kids getting their hands on these things. The Huntington Town Board voted last Tuesday to opt out of allowing cannabis retail dispensaries and on-site consumption sites as authorized by the New York State Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act. The at least it was close, though. The board voted 5-0 on the measure. Clearly, there's a lot of education here that needs to be shared. Town board member Mark Cuthbertson said by opting out, it's allowing future town boards to assess the impact of cannabis sales and retail dispensaries to make a more informed decision to opt in if it makes sense. And that's it right there, to make a more informed decision. This decision is not informed. What you guys should do, if you're on a town board and you haven't done this yet, go to a place where it is legal. Go to a dispensary. They're safe, I promise you. And see what it's like. See the kinds of people that work there. See the kinds of people that come there. You'll be surprised. You'll be pleasantly surprised. And, you know, we've seen this around the island. Where a Salt Air, that's on Fire Island. They voted to ban marijuana sales in that village. Southhold out east. Opinions are mixed among Southhold residents and officials on whether the town should opt out of allowing retail cannabis sales. They will be voting at 7 p.m. on December 28th on banning or allowing cannabis retail dispensaries and on-site consumption sites in Southhold. Residents at a December 14th public hearing on the matter mostly spoke against allowing the dispensaries. Why? Because those are the people who show up at meetings. The rest of us have to show up at meetings. the rest of us have to voice our opinions, you know, and that's not being done. That's how you get the Joe Manchins of the world, you know, because there aren't enough people in his represented area speaking out against what he does. He's afraid of the people that voted for him, as well he should be. But they're not turning out in the numbers to make him change his mind. And he would change his mind if that happened. There's no doubt about that. Anyway, getting back to this. Southold is not yet decided, December 28th, but here's who is decided. The towns of East Hampton, Hempstead, North Hempstead, Huntington, Islip, Oyster Bay, Shelter Island, and Smithtown have all opted out, as has the city of Glen Cove. Now, Riverhead, the town of Riverhead, has narrowly voted to opt in, and Brookhaven and Babylon towns have both opted in. Now, we're in Brookhaven, so we've opted in, but the reason we've opted in is because we didn't have a public hearing or we decided not to take a vote in the matter. I'm not sure which it is for our particular case. It has to be decided by the end of the year. The end of the year is a week away. Looks like some places on Long Island will opt in, and I think they will be happy with that decision. And I guarantee you, these other places who have opted out, they will be opting in. They will be opting in when they see how well it runs. And, okay, you know what? You've made it a lot easier for the rest of us because there's less that can go wrong because there's less space where this is going to be organized. You'll see how well it does. And, of course, that doesn't even count the native solution, which is already being worked upon out east.
The native solution? Well, you made that up. It is.
That's what it is.
Tribal opt-in. Yes, the Shinnecock tribe, I believe, has expressed plans to begin distribution and cultivation and distribution, I believe, and then I'm sure there's
soon, like yeah, maybe by the end of this year, which is again in a week.
To me, that's the most exciting. I think that there's a lot of symbiosis there and understanding of growth and taking care of land, and I think that could be really beneficial to the community. And I don't know, I find a lot of inspiration in communities picking a direction and going that way, yeah. Not being like, oh, well, we don't know, let's be cautious, let's wait until we can find out how much we're missing out on.
Look,
this
I see this all the time. I've seen it many, many times. Recycling, oh my god, we can't do that, we can't separate our trash, we can't have 5 cents on bottles. Guess what? We do it. Smoking, my God, you have to allow smoking on trains. How can you do that? You're not going to allow smoking in bars. Oh, my God. How about in restaurants? Guess what? We did it. We're fine. Plastic bags, as recently as a year ago. Oh, my God, how are we going to survive without plastic bags? Well, guess what? We don't have plastic bags in stores anymore, and we're doing just fine. This will work, too. And there are so many other things it could work with as well. Well, you know, introducing new forms of currency and just updating things, for God's sake. This will work.
Yeah, with it, I was just going to say, with it around, you get so many other fall-on industries and ideas around it, cultural and otherwise, technical, scientific, whether it's analysis and production techniques or packaging. That was all a part of states allowing this and it growing and continuing to grow. So we'll see more of that. And like you're suggesting, I think being a place where this stuff occurs instead of people turning their backs on it, I think that's the kind of state that we're in. And I'm eager to see how it goes. And we could talk more about this. Sure we will.
Yes, but now it's time for our feature, Films of the Year That Was, where Kyle and I venture out and see Academy Award-winning films year by year. And we started back in the 1920s, and here we are in the year 2009, where we saw both the domestic and the international winners of the Academy Award for that year. And Kyle, what film will we be starting with tonight?
Yes, La Pregunta de Sueños.
Okay, again, please, in English for the foreign film.
The Secret in Their Eyes.
The Secret in Their Eyes.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry, that was the novel. Ah, I screwed it up. El secreto de sus sueños.
Yeah, but he didn't screw it up in English. That's what it translates to in English, right? Isn't that the name of the film?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's an Argentinian crime drama.
Yeah, Argentinian. It's an Argentinian film.
As you were saying.
I was trying to say it. Yeah, it was Argentinian, I guess, a crime thriller.
Based on a novel.
Everything is based on a novel. So, coronavirus, that was based on a novel. Didn't
yes,
know that.
The novel was translated to The Question in Their Eyes.
So, what did you think?
It was a bit of a thriller. You kind of, basically, you track this, this guy, investigating a rape, a cold case, I guess is what it is. And he finds the guy who perpetrated it, confronts him. Then that guy, being sort of loosely affiliated in the crime world or the corrupt world there, ends up becoming an authority figure, working his way into being an informant because he's caught. And basically the leadership in the police sees him as an asset and basically would rather steamroll his subordinates and get this guy as an informant.
Is he an informant
something
or
like
is he just a super fascist who's part of the whole right-wing coup that's taking place?
Yeah, there's that. There's like an allying, even though across social status. Like, you could be a street criminal, but he's affiliated and he's a part of this movement. So they lap that up. They're like, well, we need you. We're going to recruit you.
Yeah, but the good guys want to put this guy in prison. In fact, they promised the husband of the murdered woman that they were going to serve a life sentence.
Yeah, we're introduced to the judiciary agent.
Uh-huh.
Benjamin Esposito. I don't really know this position.
There's a lot of little subtle differences there. But basically, you know, he's the good guy who's trying to put this person away. But, the film to me was a little confusing because it kept jumping forward to present. And honestly, I don't know if they just needed to do a better job makeup-wise. They kept saying, oh, you're an old man now. The guy didn't look that old. He didn't look that different from when they were flashing back 25 years earlier. He had a few gray hairs, but come on. He's retiring now. He's approaching the end of his life. He looks like he's 50. Okay? That's really, a little premature for that. So that right away kind of bugged me, the way it was laid out. They could have done a better job with that.
Indeed, yeah. So they're the equivalent, I think, of public defenders or prosecutors and really try to find out as much as they can, basically chasing this guy down. And they basically realize he has a passion. And there's a theme that keep coming back that what's always going to be the same about this guy. You know, what's a passion never leaves a person. You know, they might have passing moments in their lives, but the passion never leaves like who they are, their identity.
And are you talking about the killer or the hero?
The hero is realizing this as they're putting the pieces of this person together and his character is that he's a fan of football, of soccer.
When they find him, right. Now, and that led to an amazing scene in the middle of the film where basically they figured out this guy because he talks in code when he's writing a letter to his mother and they're looking into this guy. And they realize this one particular team has all those names as players. So they basically keep staking out the stadium and they're in the stadium. This is how the scene works. They're in a stadium and they see a guy a couple of rows down in what looks like a fully populated stadium. It's the wrong guy, but then they see another guy and they chase this person all throughout the stadium while the game is going on, onto the pitch. And there's this whole big scene. It must go on for about 8 or 10 minutes. And it looks like a single shot. I'm sure there was some digital trickery there. But that, I think that is why it won the Academy Award, because of that particular amazing shot in the middle of the film right there. Not so much for the story. Story was good, but it seemed to have trouble ending because as soon as you think you have it figured out, you know what? No, it didn't really go that way. It went this way instead. Oh, clever. Oh, no, but you're still wrong. It's going to go in this direction now. Okay, I just want to go home now. Look, can we end this film? It was good, but just a little over the top, a little too full of itself, I think. That's my opinion.
Yeah, and towards the end, I think there's the conclusion where he's kept alive, that I think it's been used in other films. Maybe that this was the inspiration. I don't know. That's an uncertain thing. But I felt that I'd seen that in other productions.
Did you describe what it was you're describing?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, the one of who is the person that captures him? He is
the husband captures the killer, but we don't know that to the very end. I'm sorry for ruining the film, but we always do that. You should know that by now.
That's exactly what the whole point of our discussion
here
is.
Yeah, we ruin films.
Basically ruin films
every single year. We ruin films. So the detective 25 years later wants to apologize to the husband who's now living in some isolated place. And he basically finds him and says, yeah, we never were able to find the guy. He was a fascist that was elevated to be Evita Peron's bodyguard or someone in the Peron family. We never were able to find him. Oh, well, that's the way it goes. Turns out later that the husband has been keeping him as a prisoner for this entire time. And basically, he was promised a life sentence by the detective. And he's giving him a life sentence. And the one thing that stuck with me when the prisoner encounters a detective who discovers this whole thing, he begs the detective, please just tell him to speak to me, because he has not even had that given to him. He's been just living in isolation without even being given the decency of being talked to. So that was powerful. I'll say that.
I don't know. The story and the plot, I'm still putting together, but I think that the overarching thing there is what is punishment, what is crime, what is prison and justice is, I guess, the term I was looking for. And how do we really understand that? Like, when you catch someone from this cold case after so many slow moments and it not landing anywhere and the futility of it, right? When you do catch them, what do you do? You know, or when they get some kind of vigilante justice, is that really, what do you do? How do you do it if it's not so formal as it would be in a court environment?
And if the system is so corrupt, that doesn't matter, you know, what your intentions are. They're just going to get away with it anyway.
It becomes a personal vendetta.
I see a lot of that happening. I see a lot of that happening in present day where people, no matter how guilty they are, they just keep getting away with it or postponing things. I'm not going to get into that because we don't have time. Domestic film.
The Hurt Locker.
The Hurt Locker. We just saw that. And I got to say, it was a thrilling film. It's about Iraq. And I realized after seeing this film that it doesn't matter if you're pro-war or anti-war, this film still is something that you can get something out of. They don't really take sides. They're just there. That's a fact. They're there. This is what's happening. And the film focuses on a trio of people whose job it is to disarm IEDs, bombs, things like that.
Yeah, my main problem is, in hindsight, retrospectively, looking back, this film, the whole point, his job, the main character's job, who defuses these things, sort of it rings hollow because it becomes this narrative or this heroic role that ultimately I don't think of all the bombs that were defused. When I think about that war, I think about all the ones that really hurt people, right. Ultimately as the thing wound on for years in both Afghanistan and Iraq, I feel like we did a lot less defusing. But anyway, in 08, this was what we were supposed to be real proud of, our capabilities there. Here being the expertise of this kind of rogue or kind of an ace bomb diffuser who himself, I think, is caught. And as you said, indiscernible from a good or bad. I mean, is this pro or anti-war? He becomes addicted to it.
Now that's the interesting part, because this guy, he basically doesn't play by the rules. He doesn't play by the rules. He does his own thing, and that usually works out, you know. And everybody gets mad at him until he wins, and that's your typical American story there. I thought it was done in an interesting way. The way it was filmed, it just seemed kind of I don't want to say amateurish, but it didn't have a Hollywood feel to it. It felt like I was watching someone's video camera.
Yeah, a lot of that is the handheld techniques that were used, and so you're riding along in and I saw some of the extra features showing them in like rickshaws and in wheelbarrow and various forms of transportation. You really are riding along with the mm-hmm. equipment, and that I think is part of a texture and of disorientation and lacking a sense of home or belonging.
I did feel like I was part of that ride. So it succeeded in that. I didn't like the ride. I thought it was hell. I thought it was terrible. I was reminded, as you were saying, of all the hell that we've brought to these countries. And yeah, all those bombs that are going off wouldn't have gone off had we not done this. We have to keep remembering that. And we did not leave the place better than we found it, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it just is like speaks to this exceptionalism of like, well, oh, we'll just bring the guys that'll fix those things that people are going to leave for us. Like, we'll fix it this way. We've got a thing for that. And it's a lot more, it's a lot deeper. It had an effect. It was the first guy that our protagonist replaces was killed by this occupation.
Right.
In the very early minutes of the movie. So it just, I find it, it's a little funny to think of us having, you know, solved that threat in reality. It was ongoing, and it wasn't the key to it. It was just a component of that.
You know, I promised to say what my phone's been doing all this time, but let me first close this segment by saying you came up with a great analogy to the film that I don't think anybody else has come up with. We're basically, and we're going to ruin this film too, the guy goes home, his tour is over, and boy, my phone is annoying. And if anybody can tell me what that chime is, what it means, write in and let us know, and we'll say if you're right. But basically, he goes home and he realizes there's nothing there for him. He even says to his infant son that as you get older, you only love two or three things in your life, and maybe only one. Basically, telling his kid, that infant, that he doesn't love him. He only loves war. He goes back to war, and the analogy was America. You know, no matter how many times we get out of something, we just are propelled back into something else because we are in love with war and violence and mayhem and destruction. And I don't know if that was the intentional message of the film, but that's a damn good message. And I think a good note to end on. Yes, until next week. And my phone, basically my phone has been going off every few seconds to tell me that I'm out of signal because we're in sort of a cave here. And occasionally I lose signal. And now my phone has decided that it's going to alert me audibly every time I lose signal every few seconds. And I can't turn it off. It's driving me crazy. It's killing my battery. And I want to throw my phone in a river. But that's my problem. All right. It is Christmas time. Everyone's playing Christmas carols. I'd like to play something from someone who doesn't usually get played. One of my favorite artists of all time, June Lodge, also known as J.C. Lodge. Stay tuned for Finn. We will see you next week. Good night. Oh,
right here, Finn's Revolution on WUSB Stony Brook until the 9 p.m. hour. Tonight we have a very, very special pair of guests. We have Alexander Hacke of Einstürzende Neubauten and Danielle DiPicciato. And they're part of Hacke DiPicciato, and they're going to be talking about their new release and then blasting Christmas music. Yeah, hopefully you guys are well and safe in this holiday season and will remain so. I hope you do. I hope we all do. And, well, almost all of us, you know, the usual. We're going to listen to something right now from the brand new Hacke DiPicciato album, which is called The Silver Threshold. And right after this, we're going to be talking to Alexander and Danielle right here on these airwaves from Berlin, I believe. Stay tuned. This is brand new from Hacke DiPicciato. We'll be right back.
That was the title track from the Silver Threshold, brand new, gorgeous record, as usual, from Haka de Picciotto, and just great stuff. And we are lucky enough right now on Finn's Revolution on WUSB to have Danielle and Alexander with us, and just amazing players, and we're going to get into everyone's history and stuff like that as well. And welcome to both of you to Finn's Revolution again.
Hey, oh,
thank you.
Thanks great for having us.
Yeah, great to be back.
It's great to have you on, as always. And this is a beautiful, beautiful record. And as you guys who are listening have gotten the general picture here, these are like deep, beautiful soundscapes, occasionally with some lyrics, but in general, these beautiful, gorgeous, lush, dark soundscapes, and just great, great work. First of all, you guys, as some of our listeners know, are a couple for quite a while now. Yeah.
Yep.
Yes.
How long have you guys been together as a couple?
As a couple since 2001.
Okay.
So 20 years.
Yeah. Congratulations.
So we've known each other basically since I moved to Berlin, which was 1987.
Okay. So how did you guys meet?
When I moved to Berlin, I moved into this kind of typical huge factory loft of the 80s in Berlin, and there were four people living in there, and one of the members was the keyboard player of Nick Cave back then, Roland Wolf, mm-hmm. and he was good friends with Neubauten, and Alex was his best friend, and so I met them pretty quickly on, I think, a week later after I moved to Berlin, because they were always visiting Roland.
Right. And, of course, the Neubauten Collective we're going to discuss in a little bit, just touch on that. So how long did it take for you guys to become musical partners?
When we started getting together in 2001, first we would do audio-visual projects together, where I would provide the music and Danielle would do like projections or other kind of concepts that then I would score for or something like that. And eventually we got into actually playing music together. The last project that we did where it was still sort of divided was The Ship of Fools. That was a thing based on a medieval book by Sebastian Brandt. And from there on, we started, pretty much when we started to live as nomads in 2010, we would be a proper band.